Hello there, new listener. Thanks for taking the time to check out the Poor Historians podcast. Hey, it makes sense to start the first chapter, but then again, I have to acknowledge that being a doctor does not mean you know anything about audio production. Admittedly, we ironed out some technical issues in the first two episodes. So if you find the audio quality to be a bit distracting, we're not offended if you skip ahead to episode 3. Things do go up from there. Think of the first two episodes as that early stuff from that band you like. Objectively, those early albums had some good bones, but they could have been better produced. They still hold that sentimental place in their hearts, and maybe yours too. Anyway, if you stay around for this episode, welcome to the show, and we'll see you down the line. We won't actually see you. We won't really even hear you, I guess. I mean, unless you send us an email or something. That'd be awesome. Talk to us. We love it. Warning, this podcast will have some bad words. Conversation around a 19th century English water pump.
Hello, Governor. You quite finished collecting water?
I'm drawing water, and I'll be done in a minute.
You've been here for a minute yet? What's taking so long?
Well, I have to pump it by hand, don't I? It takes some time.
I don't know that it takes me that long to draw the water. Maybe you need to work on that pumping arm a bit.
Are you quite finished hassling me?
Not quite. What are you doing?
If you must know, I'm trying to sift off some of this sediment and debris. It's awfully hairy water today.
Nothing wrong with a bit of hair in your water. It adds roughage. Good for the digestion, if you ask me.
Well, my wife would beg to differ. She certainly had no problems moving her bowels the past few days. I think it has to do with all this roughage floating in the water, don't you?
I've been drinking this brackish water, hair and all, my whole life, and I'm as fit as a fiddle. No problems here.
What? You're having diarrhea right now.
Yep, I am. What of it?
Nothing at all. Well, I'm going to go now. The pump is all yours.
It's about time. Some people's manners leave some hairy water for the rest of us.
Poor historians. Poor historians. Yeah, cases draw history. It's just Max and Aaron, Mac and me. You gotta listen, you don't have to read. Poor historians, poor historians, poor historians. Nice.
Nailed it.
Dude, what the hell?
I don't know where that accent was from, Mike, but
it was good. All over. It was global.
It was.
The Scottstralian accent.
Welcome to everyone. You are listening to Poor Historians, the podcast delving into the archives of medical history. We will explore the unusual ailments, treatments, physicians, and all related material having to do with the healing arts. I'm Max, and I'm joined here by my good friends and colleagues, Aaron and Mike. Gentlemen, how are you?
Good. Good, good.
Doing well. Superman's good. I'm well. Right?
All right. Good. It's interesting.
Is that a thing? I don't know. I just always feel like I'm really stuck up and pretentious when I say, when somebody asks me how I'm doing, and I say I'm doing well.
No. Grammar is important. It's the fabric that binds our society together. So
I don't have any grammars anymore.
Wow. Though we are all practicing emergency physicians, we wish to be clear that this is not a podcast from which you or anybody should take medical advice. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. If we should fail in our goal to provide entertainment, well, I guess this is just a podcast that exists, but it exists to definitely not provide medical advice. With that, let's start the show. So, Aaron, what are we going to talk about here?
Well, we're going to talk about sewer gas in general and a bit of Victorian England. So take yourself back for a minute to the mid-1800s. The urbanization of the Industrial Revolution has gathered people together in London, a teeming morass of humanity, much more densely packed than anything that had previously existed in the world. And unfortunately, this collection of people preceded any sort of modern sewer system. and all those people produced a lot of crap, and all of it essentially flowed to the, what is it, the Thames River, or was literally carried
Thames.
There.
It is the Thames River.
Thames.
I think it's
I'm fairly sure Thomas. Mike knows the correct pronunciation. Yeah, Mike, you have Thomas. Background. The Thomas that? River.
The Thomas River?
No,
the
Thomas. Thomas.
I thought it was the Tom. The
Thames. I also want to point out that how proud I am that Mike did not make a joke after you said morass.
Well, yes, it works on so many levels.
I think we're all growing as people.
We are. So all this stuff went down to the Thames and was carried there from cesspools below homes, basically untreated. And this river was also the source of all the drinking water for London. So, an obvious problem there. But in fact, the river was a huge job creator. Pooping was what counted for being a job creator back in the 1800s. But I digress there for a minute. So there were people in different classes of jobs that collected dog poop and carcasses and human poop as fertilizer along the edge of the river, as well as people that collected rags and copper collectors, all this stuff that just went down to the end of where it was on its way out to the sea. Apparently, they broke down into trades, and estimates put the number of people doing these jobs in the hundreds of thousands at a time when the total population was about 2 million.
So it's I always like the fantasy that every generation has had that things were always better back in the day. The fact that in the 1850s, your jobs could include picking up carcasses and shoveling literal human and animal waste in the absence of any antibiotics or modern medicine, does not suggest that there are better times before.
Oh, and you know there was beef between the different levels, right? Like they would, you know, they were
between the different levels of.
The different levels of collectors, you know, like the copper collectors are like, oh my God, I would never be a carcass collector.
But absolutely.
Who shits out copper? That's what I want to know. Why does it end up in the...
You really want to go for the copper collecting job. Like that's...
That would be the best one. It's easiest to see, right? You know, you can wash it at least somewhat.
Right. I mean, you're at that job fair and you're probably not making your way over to the carcass collection.
Maybe booth. The next one down is like peanut collector, then corn collector.
Those are specialties, those are subspecialties, and that was all subcontracted out, if I'm not mistaken.
This is what they mean by, yeah, shit flows downhill. I mean, literally, like, each job down the way is worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, definitely.
But then the dead body, like, that's probably upstream. That probably sucks, too.
Well, yeah. There's probably, like, the weird kid that really wants that job, and nobody wants to ask questions as to why. And
everyone wonders.
You want to see a dead body, Governor?
So in fact, the time-honored job of collecting night soil, as it was called, and then reselling it to farmers, was relatively prestigious among the classes that formed the waste management infrastructure of Victorian England. So they could charge a shilling for a cesspool, which was twice the going wage for labor at that time. Unfortunately, the fact that these cesspools had to be emptied by hand is a sign of the infrastructure in these sewers and streams in London sort of mingled, and a lot of people would use the same water for drinking and bathing. They'd take the water out of the sewers, let it settle, and then skim off the solids, which would absolutely include hair and all sorts of other weird stuff. So, but we'll hold on to that for a minute for later.
Do you think they wore masks when they did that?
The rag collectors probably made masks out of what they found.
Out of their rags, yeah.
It's probably this whole microeconomy where the rag collectors had to negotiate with the shit collectors, and you know they would trade rags.
What were the rags used for? To strain the stool?
That could be. I mean, who knows? I don't know. There's a lot more here to dig into. So,
and we're suggesting that England or London around the time is going to be the more advanced society. So even though it's gross, it was probably better than other places. Is that what we're saying?
Well, at the time, I don't know if it was better, to be honest. I mean, no one had ever collected this way. So as we'll see with this story, it had consequences. So before the mid-1850s, kind of the status quo that all this stuff was going on, which bears thinking about for a minute, given how extraordinarily sensitive we are to smells currently. So in the emergency department, you know, we often will encounter smells, and that's certainly not the fault of the patients, but some of them can be quite strong. So, you know, we do things like we'll actually nebulize coffee into a room or, you know, put peppermint oil in our masks and all those sorts of things. But in the 1850s, I mean, people essentially lived in this open sewer. So,
yeah, but when you do those things, I mean, how often does it help, or how often does it just make the smell in the room just smell like mint or coffee flavored
poo.
Yeah.
It's like a little spearmint poo.
I don't know if that's better, is what I'm saying. I don't know that that's better.
You always run the risk of ruining the thing you're trying to have help you. So
right. I mean, I just walk in there and it's like, well, now this is unpleasant on two levels.
I mean, somewhere in residency, I developed this Pavlovian response that if there's some sort of bowel related problem, I actually will usually go and eat a Clif Bar right after that. And I'm not sure what happened, but that's just, it's weird. I don't try to think about it too much. So
tell me about your childhood.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't think that's the theme of the show. So all around this time, 1850s, few factors brought all of this to a head. The population tripled. So the most crowded part of London at that time was more than four times as crowded as modern day Manhattan. There was also at that time the invention of the flush toilet, which was fabulous. So you had water in your house to actually go to the bathroom and flush it away. But this preceded again the invention of the modern sewer. So really, it just increased the amount of water going with the poo into the cesspools, and they just overflowed. So, you know, the whole where I'm headed with all of this is essentially cholera. So there was a disease at that time that was passed through the fecal-oral route and such. And that's kind of what this is leading towards. And although not implicated in that specific epidemic, there were also livestock in the area, so they didn't have any zoning. You know, I think I can have up to three chickens in Wauwatosa right now. But back then you could have, you know, pigs, horses, sheep. There were slaughterhouses, there were tanneries, everything was kind of all together. So in this setting, the prevailing health concept of the time was something called the miasma theory. Now, miasma is a Greek word meaning pollution. And through Greek times until the 1880s, when they figured out germs, it was felt that these sort of bad odors led to health problems, even to the point that they thought things like chlamydia and obesity were blamed on miasma and odors and such. I mean, obesity was related to the odors of food. I don't know. I didn't dig into which miasma led to chlamydia, but
we all know how they got there.
The odors of love.
Okay, fair. Yeah.
Pheromones, yeah.
Yeah, pheromones.
Yeah. But you can't smell them.
Chlamydial pheromones? Is that?
Well, no. I mean, saying like if you had pheromones that you want to then, you know, like put yourself at risk for getting chlamydia.
I think a lot of people will put themselves at risk for getting chlamydia just for the sake of. Let's move on.
Yes. So the miasma theory, based on our noses, essentially was helpful with regards to the development of sanitation because it did make people want to clean things up, but it was tragically wrong with regards to the cause of so many pathogens that don't cause a smell at all. So this environment in this background, the cholera outbreak of 1854 was particularly famous for a number of reasons. So very, very crowded area of London, one where some patient zero had a bowel movement full of cholera and it drained into a cesspit below the house or near the street. And this was along a street called Broad Street. So a very crowded street of the time, but there happened to be a favorite communal water pump. The Broad Street pump is what it was called. And it was fabled for the good taste and mild carbonation, which always makes me a little leery when I read that because obviously it wasn't carbonated in any way. It was just a well.
Perrier pumped in under the street. That's exactly. Concerning where that carbonation came from.
For sure. Only about 25 feet deep. So, I mean, I'm not on well water here, but I mean, most wells are quite a bit deeper than that. And it was dug right next to a cesspit. So you can see where these problems come. And in 1854, a huge cholera outbreak started killing more than 10% of those affected and sort of emptying out that neighborhood.
I see what you did there.
So cholera itself, still a massive killer and historically was a plague. So the London epidemic had a fatality rate over 10%, but it's still a cholera outbreak is an epidemic or a mortality rate around 4-5% and can kill children with dehydration in hours or days. About 120,000 people a year it still kills. And in med school, we talked about this sort of rice water stool description. You know, diarrhea doesn't really give justice to this disease's ability to just empty your entire blood volume out your rectum by pulling fluid and salt into the colon within hours. So
I think we all have a memory vividly of that video in med school. Did you guys see the video?
Oh, yeah.
They show you the 1960s newsreel of the cholera cot.
Yep.
That was a memorable day.
Mike has blocked it out. I totally remember that video. It was
the only video I really remember is that rabies video.
Oh yeah, I remember there's rabies video. It's giving there are disturbing moments in medical school.
Yeah,
yeah,
like driver's ed videos, except way worse. Yeah. So,
and in fairness, too, Aaron, you forgot to mention that cholera was a major cause of death in the Oregon Trail video game. You know, it was like cholera, dysentery, drowning, and snake bites. Many a tombstone exists on an Apple IIe because of it. That doesn't
they had to split it into two, right? Cholera and or dysentery.
Well, one's bloody.
Yes. I agree. So not that well known in this before the 1700s in Europe, but known in India and Asia for millennia before that. And it's unclear whether it was sort of brought back from India, given England's involvement there. If so, then maybe a little bit of karma. But once it came, there were these sort of waves of epidemics in Europe. And people were understandably quite terrified because they didn't really know what the source was. But the word cholera itself may come from the Greek for roof gutter, as in that's a description of how your colon empties. So it's past. We now know the best known route for almost all diseases or our favorites, right? Fecal to oral passage. So somehow bacteria has to get from a sick person's rectum to a well person's mouth. And now we like to think that that's, you know, a little bit more difficult. Unfortunately, it's kind of not. But going back to 1850s, it's pretty easy to see how that would happen, typically through unfiltered drinking water or in the process of caring for someone who's ill. I mean, where do you even wash your hands when the water's not purified? There's no Purell. The thing that helps people is that you need a large dose to get sick because your stomach can kill off a fair amount of cholera bacteria. So
every time I see that fecal to oral route, I'm a very visual person, so I picture someone's lips on someone's butthole. But I understand that doesn't mean that they have to lick someone's butthole to get it.
There are questions. I have questions.
But then I would also argue that if we went back in time and drank even their best water, we would be shitting our brains out.
Oh, totally.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Our modern guts are no match for whatever they had back then. There's no way.
We're weak.
We are weak. We become weak. So doctors of the day did not exactly cover themselves in glory trying to treat cholera. There was no such thing as germ theory, let alone any sort of trials. And there's a record of one doctor actually getting it right and simply rehydrating the patient. That's in resource poor settings in the modern world. You actually can do very well with just little oral rehydration packets and such. The list of possible remedies range from useless, like opium and cleaning the house. I'm not sure how that would help. to disastrous. You know,
I refuse to take the stand that opium is useless.
Well, okay, fair. I mean, at least if you're in the unlucky 10%, it would make things, it'd be palliative. I mean,
at least if you're dying of cholera and you're full of opium.
Well, and actually,
that's something. Know,
would theoretically slow the colon, maybe a little.
I would think it should actually work to slow diarrhea. I mean,
do you want to do that? Is it kind of like salmonella?
Not to my knowledge. That's a great question. I should know. That's a boards type question about whether it's a toxin producing bacteria.
I'm just saying, if it's 1850s and I have cholera, I'm totally fine taking a bunch of opium because in the absence of knowing what anybody is doing medically, sure.
Yeah. Especially if you went back in time again, which, you know, the more palliative we do this, care. The less I want to go back in
and
time.
How, you know, it really wouldn't be that hard to clean a house back then, because truly you probably only had what you needed. It's not like
it's true. It's not like
extra
today.
Rooms.
Yeah, there's no knickknacks.
It's fair.
You know,
it's fair.
There's one bench.
You shit in the sink that you wash the dishes in.
So other people, though, actually would prescribe laxatives, castor oil, or leeches and bloodletting for patients that were suffering from cholera, all of which would make it way worse. So because the way it kills you, of course, is you just lose volume to the point that you can't even support your circulation. And if you're bleeding somebody, that makes it way worse. So
it's like the reverse psychology approach.
with bacteria.
Yeah. Good make point. It worse so that it gets better.
So this outbreak, though, tipping point, founded modern epidemiology in a sense. There's a physician named John Snow. He had previously made his name as the most famous anesthetist in Britain, according to Wikipedia, because he knew how to use ether and chloroform. So he had a dynamic duo going there.
Hey, Aaron. Aaron. I heard he was a bastard.
I cannot disprove that. I cannot. Yes. Might have had a different last name, too. So he's been observing patterns of infection. And the miasma theory doesn't wash. He thinks it's something that's ingested. He's like, no, it's not the gas. It's the poo in the water that's getting people, you know, shocking. He's been working on cholera for years and analyzing stools and talking to families and so on. And goes public with theory that cholera is ingested in 1849. So perhaps because of this theory, the Broad Street pump, famous as it is, becomes a symbol of the 1854 outbreak. Everyone sort of loves this in accounts. It's fabled for good taste and shallow, and during the outbreak, with clusters around the pumps, Snow and others apparently convinced the town council to remove the pump handle. Genius, problem solved, no bad water. And there's actually an account of him like demanding an audience with a local city council and such and bursting in and saying, we have to remove this handle.
So, like, I'd like to think that there was, on the other end, like, the pro-cholera politician who is taking the active stance against that. Our people have a right to decide for themselves whether or not they want the communal fizzy diarrhea water.
That's right. Take away the pump, you take away our freedom. So he actually published a good paper on it, does publish a map that shows quite a few cases around the pump, but he also connects houses to local water suppliers, and the ones that drew straight from the Thames, shockingly, seem to correlate to a higher infection rate. There are reports from that time of water coming out of the tap with hair and sludge in it directly, and it turns out that's probably more of a key difference. By happenstance, Snow is presented with an analog of a modern randomized controlled trial as different residences right next to each other, literally sharing walls, receive water from different sources, and the mortality tracks with the bad water suppliers, as it were. So that's probably the bigger story here. We like to think that modern medicine is effective, and it is definitely, we could save probably almost all of those cholera victims, but it would be overwhelming. So a full-scale outbreak in 3,000 patients within a few days' time, as we've seen, would overwhelm our resources pretty quickly, even though it's a simple thing to, in modern medicine, treat, you know, this type of shock.
If that was a pandemic, though, the toilet paper thing would make so much more sense.
Just much more sense, yes.
So respiratory virus, illness. Toilet paper. Nope. Cholera outbreak makes sense, though.
Yes.
You could argue that normal saline is probably the most important medicine that's ever been invented over time.
Yeah.
Because it's big. Yeah, that's why people don't die from this, is because they have saline.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, I mean, so we don't think of cholera here. I mean, but a lot of it's probably more sanitation than us. So, I mean, the real story, and maybe we can revisit this sometime in the future, is how important modern sewers are to our health. So Snow was proven correct just decades after he had observed transmission. And now we know how important it is for all cities. So everyone likes to talk about the pump handle. And I agree, a 20-foot deep well next to an open sewer cistern is not ideal. But really, what helped stop cholera was getting the water clean at the source, and that's what eventually led to the solution.
Well, there we go. It's like the best thing to come out of a cholera outbreak.
That's right.
Modern epidemiology.
Yeah, you can see he has little hand-drawn maps, and the little houses are colored different colors. It's really cool.
All right, well, that is more than I ever thought I would want to know about early English sewer systems, or lack thereof. So we will take a break, and we'll go over to the next segment here.
Two gentlemen are laboring at a cesspool.
Boy, what are you doing here?
What's it look like I'm doing? Same thing you're doing. I'm emptying this cesspit.
Isn't this a cesspool?
Does it matter? Really?
I suppose not. I mean, what are you doing here in my cesspool? I've already got the contract to empty this one.
Contract? Well, who do you have a contract?
None of your business. This is my cesspool, and I intend to be paid to empty it.
You don't even have a proper bucket. This one's full of holes. What do you expect to accomplish with this?
My main bucket is in the shop. It'll be fixed soon. I saw this cesspool first. Go find your own fecal gold mine to empty by hand, one bucket at a time.
One holy bucket at a time.
Are you even in the union? How could you have this job?
I'll have you know I'm an independent contractor. I'm my own boss, thank you very much.
Well, this here's a union job site, and if you ain't with the union, you ain't supposed to be here. Hey, boss.
Yeah, there.
This guy here is emptying our cesspool. He thinks just anyone can do this.
Oh, yeah? Well, there's your certification card. How do I know you have the adequate qualifications to try and empty this here cesspit?
I got a bucket in an ironclad stomach. That's enough qualification for you, if you ask me. Your man doesn't even have an intact bucket. Look here. There's slop coming out from all sides.
The union is in negotiations for better buckets.
Ah, for heaven's sake. Fine. I'll go elsewhere. But I'm taking my bucket with me. Say good day to you both. I know my mother was right. I should have gone into carcass collection where they don't have to put up with this shit.
All right, and we are back. In this next segment, we're going to be talking about what was going on 100 years ago or so in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I picked out an article. The article is Treatment of Hypertrophied Tonsils and Adenoids by Radium, a Preliminary Statement.
Well, thank God it's preliminary.
Oh, absolutely. So it turns out that the New England Journal of Medicine wasn't just a repository for the best thoughts on what exactly was causing the major illnesses of the day, but it was also a place where a doc could float ideas on his or her next best big medical technology invention. Just kind of thought he had a good idea. Go ahead and try it out. So back in the day, before the hassle of proposing some sort of medical treatment or device to the Food and Drug Administration, you know, prior to actually even testing it or using it, you could just try stuff out and write about it. You see, there was a time where enlarged tonsils were a plague on humanity. Sure, one could have them taken out if they were causing a problem, but that surgery isn't fun even today, let alone in an age where the family doc came to your house. Your family helped pin you down to a kitchen table and removed the tonsils by brute force. That's literally what they did to my own grandfather. He remembered it. Happened sometime in the 30s. They came to the house.
In the 30s?
Oh, yeah.
The Depression era? As if things were bad enough already.
Yep, yep. So, I mean, tonsils are just being taken out left and right. And I, you know, still to this day, but just they were very preoccupied with tonsils back then. So I found this article from March 10th. 1921, written by Dr. Francis Williams. It's coming from Boston, which most of these will. So he came up with a different, if not better, solution. I don't think it's much better, though, to the problem of enlarged tonsils. So his article piggybacks off a previous article titled, quote, Induced Atrophy of Hypertrophied Tonsils by Röntgen Ray, published shortly before, which found that kind of vaguely aiming an x-ray beam to the back of the neck towards where the tonsils might be can actually cause them to shrink.
Well, yeah, but oh my God. Okay.
Yeah, but you know, if you use radiation to burn away tissue, it disappears. Not isn't that it doesn't work, Aaron.
For a while.
For a while, yeah. Isn't röntgenologist, isn't that like an old-timey name for a radiologist?
Yep, that's Röntgen. The...
Where did
is Röntgen? It Röntgen?
Röntgen or Röntgen? I always thought it was Röntgen.
Is it GIF or GIF?
And that's why we call them x-rays, because it's easier to say.
It's a lot of vowels.
Where does the X come from? Because it's an x-ray.
It comes from near the end of the alphabet.
Yeah, but Röntgen is probably the guy. I thought it was Marie Curie, wasn't it?
Well, she was she was like the discovered radium and unfortunately the side effects. But I believe Röntgen was the guy who came up with like actually taking x-rays. We should fact check that in a future episode.
We're not going to do that.
We might do
are
that.
Are we going to do that? I don't
know. We might do that. But we're going to figure out, in the future episode, we're going to figure out how to pronounce Röntgen. So anywho, Dr. Williams read that article and said to himself, there must be a better way. You can cue up any images of every person in an infomercial dropping all the crap they're holding to the floor, looking exasperated. So
somebody
he devised
pushing
and proposed
an x-ray up to somebody's face and trying to angle it so it gets to their throat.
Oh. Just burning off the skin or
how many times
core
of
radium falls out and drops it and shrugging his shoulders, looking at the camera.
Tired of accidentally causing blindness with your x-ray technology?
Oh, you probably weren't back then. So imagine, if you will, a device that looks like a metal phallic tube with a pistol grip, measuring, according to the article, 30 centimeters in length and no more than 2 centimeters in diameter.
This is so bad.
Wait, this is a Röntgen ray?
Nope. This is a tonsil treatment device.
The new invention. Oh.
True story. So this would be advanced over your tongue to sit with the tip right between the tonsils.
Just the tip.
In the tip.
Just the tip between the tonsils, yes.
I knew that was coming. The tip of the device, there was, quote, 50 milligrams of bromine of radium. And along the tip of the device, there were holes that could be opened to expose the tissues in front of them to the radiation from the radium in a sort of directed fashion. So it's sort of like if you can picture like this slide system where you could turn it and it would open the hole from the outer surface of this device to the radium, and it would kind of direct a beam, I guess, in a totally uncontrolled, non-computerized fashion, you know, to the side of the device. So Dr. Williams recommended, quote, the radium should be withdrawn every few minutes, or as often as is comfortable for the patient, until the total exposure of 15 minutes, more or less, has been reached. So basically, radiation burned those tonsils until they're medium well. Not well done, though. I mean, it's not what we're aiming for here. Unless you think this method is crude, there were some thoughts given, at least, to the patient's comfort. Quote, before applying the radium, the throat should be moistened with a suitable solution of cocaine to prevent gagging from the insertion of the container. But, you don't want to burn a parched throat, I guess. Medicine was way more fun back then.
Yes. A lot of patients probably like, nah, still gagging, still can't. I need a little more of that, a little more cocaine. Then I'll be good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Is that what the Eric Clapton song is about? Getting your tonsils irradiated?
It kind of is. It's the subtext of the song. So I was surprised to see the next part. Quote, all instruments should be covered with two thicknesses of rubber. And for this purpose, two rubber finger cots are stretched over them and far down on the handle, where they may be secured by a strip of plaster. Of course, fresh cots should be used for each patient. There's definitely a joke about double bagging here that I am too mature to make.
Could you imagine if... And I don't know if condoms were commercially available. I'm sure you could make your own out of whatever dinner you're going to have, like grab some intestines and whatever. But
and still
just
do.
Imagine the description on those things. Yes. You know, like they would be amazing. You know, insert your phallus into the cock.
Oh, you're talking about the instructions.
Yeah, the instructions on the pack of a condom.
Well, they didn't have, I'm sure they didn't have health class. So how are you going to learn?
No, but just so particular. Like, you know exactly how to put this finger cut on this device.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure.
A lot of trial.
It's weird when
here.
The instructions talk about using your mouth to do it is where the line is.
This guy.
Oh my gosh. This guy. This guy.
This guy.
So there are definitely some reasonable further discussion points, including, you know, limiting the duration of the throat radiation treatment in children, you know, naturally, though not necessarily exempting them. Suggesting a nose-penetrating device to reach those pesky adenoids was also a thing he came up with, and suggests that might be needed in the future. And he also acknowledged the disadvantage of this method as, quote, obvious, end quote, being, quote, the wrench and rays should be employed only by physicians who have had experience in their use.
Excellent.
Which seems odd when you're coming up with something new and saying, we need experts.
Yep, protecting the monopoly on care so only certain people can charge for it.
So it seems as if this method was suggested simply for enlarged tonsils and adenoids, but the author suspected it could be used for acute cases of infectious tonsillitis as well. And so Dr. Williams said he has tried the method already and observed, quote, striking improvement. So I, for one, might opt to continue using penicillin for strep tonsillitis, but hey, each their own.
You can either take antibiotics or here I have a radioactive dildo that you need to hold in your throat for 15 minutes. It'll be way better.
Well, I believe at the time he published this, it probably was only the radioactive dildo as an option.
It's true. It's true. That's a good point.
With that in mind, any things you guys wanted to try out without any consent on in the future in your medical practice?
Yeah.
I mean, we have this now. It's called TikTok, actually. So
really, you can do medical procedures on TikTok.
Oh, have you seen
some medical procedures on TikTok?
Some of those TikToks of people intubating mannequins with like fancy styles—that is definitely unsanctioned medical experimentation. But thankfully, they seem to only do it on mannequins.
Mm-hmm. What about womanikins? Have they ever done it on them?
That's an interesting point. That. We're probably gendering our mannequins. improperly.
And with that.
Oh, I just want to let you know that I did Google. Can we say Google? Is that an advertising? I mean, do we get...
No.
No, it's anyway. Free advertising. They would, no, because it would fall under the... If you just said Google and every time you mentioned Google, it was some sort of weird, disparaging, dark place, it's fine. But we used their... You used Google to find an answer to something, and they would very much want us to say that.
Yep. So the answer is...
Röntgen.
So it's a hard Röntgen. G.
Yeah, that's the... Well, hard wait G. a second. Wait a second. Here's the...
Röntgen.
That's the British pronunciation. Apparently, they're robots. Röntgen. We did our accents wrong.
Well, I'm just going to close the show here. Thank you to everyone and anyone listening. I hope we all learned something. We'll be back in a few weeks with the next episode. Until then, I will continue to be Max. Aaron and Michael continue to be themselves, and we are, as of now, signing off. Exit music.
A few weeks. Well, that's a probably. That's fair. I like setting expectations low. Hey, mate, what are you doing here?
I think the mate threw you off.
I didn't say his good accent, but I've never had a good accent.
No, but it was
seamless.
All right. I'll try again.
That totally could have happened in a conversation. We should just keep going. All right, I'll try to keep it together.
All right, 3, 2. Hey, mate, what are you doing here?
We could take the mate out if it's...
No, it's fine.
Oi! I'll change this to oi, how about that?
All right.
I'll try it again. All right. 3, 2. Oi! What...
If we had Patreon subscribers, this would go there in the outtakes.
Well, someday, right?
Yep.
Someday.
Wait, Patreon's the one where we've got to take pictures of our buttholes and upload them, right? Is that something different?
That's
something different. Okay.
Because I've got a bunch of pictures. I don't need to. I'll just send them over.
Oh, man, TMI.
Now, that's what I call a butthole.